All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Big Bang and Krishnism podcast. It's been about half a year. I thought the intro music kind of suited it, my epic return to podcasting. So I guess I'll fill you in on what I've been doing for this half a year. Joined college, been taking a lot of classes, working towards my major in math and physics, and I've learned a lot in these 2 quarters, so I thought I'd try to take some of the stuff I've learned in my formal education and pass it on, use it in my podcast, as well as focus on the stuff with the creation evolution quote-unquote controversy that I still do as a hobby. I joined the Secular Student Alliance at my college, and there are a lot of other students, and by a lot I mean about 8. We don't have that many in our group yet, because we just had to start it over this year. All the people who were in it last year graduated. So we had to start the group over again, but the point is there are a lot of people in the group who share my interest in creationism and evolution. In fact, a fellow podcaster who runs the Thought-Provoking Discussion podcast is also a member of the Alliance. And we've done most of our events of the Secular Student Alliance revolving around promoting the teaching of evolution and the dismissal of intelligent design and creationism as non-science. We've done about 3 or 4 events on campus, and 3 of them, they've all been pretty small, but 3 of them have been focused around evolution and creationism. Now, being active in the club, coupled with this fact that I learned a lot more in my physics classes over the past 2 quarters, I thought it'd be a good time to do some reading on creationism and maybe bring back the podcast. I hadn't heard a lot from anyone else, but I know my father continually nagged me to keep going with the podcast because he wanted to hear the weekly episodes. So I figured it'd be something I'd be interested in starting back up. Just need something to use my time up, and I also enjoy doing the podcast, of course. I'm not just doing it to keep myself out of boredom. So I really hope to get this thing started back up and keep it going instead of doing what I did last time, which go for a year, kind of get bored, run out of topics to talk about, and then just quit. So hopefully we'll be able to keep this one going for a lot longer than I had it go last time. So I've got quite a bit planned for this kind of going back into podcasting episode, the comeback episode, I guess I could call it. But I'd like to give a little intro to this creationist claim before I actually start going over it. I had spring break about a week ago, and I went to talk to some high schoolers in a philosophy club that my sister's a part of about my atheism in general, but the conversation kind of leaned towards creationism and evolution. And there was one of the members there, especially that my sister wanted me to talk to, who was an avid creationist, and he wanted to defend his views against what science has to say. So he brought up many of the claims I've already discussed on the podcast, and there were some that I hadn't heard of but didn't really seem to be applicable, but he did bring up one that I had heard of, but I'd not actually done much looking into. I knew there was a refutation to this on Talk of Origins, but I figured I would kind of use that as an initial source and then use some of the scientific journals that I have access to now that I'm part of the college to approach this claim. And I ended up writing an email to him, which I will also try and provide for you on the website. The argument is one of the more scientific-sounding of creationist arguments, specifically because the man who developed the claim, Robert Gentry, published the notion of polonium halos in the scientific journal, though he didn't really mention this conclusion of a 6,000-year-old Earth in the journals because, of course, he wouldn't have been allowed to post that in the journal because it's not science. So the creationist claim I'll be tackling today is the notion of these polonium halos, and I'll describe what those are in just a bit. The claim goes something like this. The emission of radiation by the element polonium would disappear in molten rock because the emission of radiation of polonium, as it decays, it does so in such a short amount of time that we wouldn't actually see any evidence of this in the molten rock. But such radiation would be preserved if the rock were to, say, solidify instantly, so that when this emission goes out, it'll be stuck in the rock and it wouldn't dissipate in this molten rock that's kind of flowing every which way. Of course, then, Gentry takes a wild jump from this instant solidification of rock as evidence that the Earth is somehow 6,000 years old. And the reason he does this is because he believes the samples he took were from very primordial rock. Of course, he only takes it from a few places, and he kind of makes the conclusion that it's the entire Earth that also forms this way. So again, that's also a big jump. And we'll talk about exactly where Gentry got these samples of primordial rock, kind of say that with quotations in mind, because they aren't really primordial rocks, when I talk about exactly what these halos are. So there are a few things wrong with Gentry's claim that I found out. In particular, the 2 things that I saw were that his samples don't exhibit these characteristics of hypothetical polonium halos. And also, the rocks from which he took his samples are not primordial. Gentry makes some claims about the content of his samples that is dubious, too, such as he says there's very, very tiny amounts of uranium in his samples, and the very fact that he says that is kind of bizarre, and we'll talk about that when we realize where he gets his samples from. Now, when rocks form, let's go back and see how exactly these polonium halos would form. When rocks form, they may contain radioactive particles of a certain element. And these elements have certain half-lives, which they will decay into other elements and so on, forming what's known as a decay chain. Now, each one of these half-lives leads to a new discoloration ring, as energy is given off as an alpha particle in order to decay into another element. For example, uranium-234 decays into thorium-230, and this decay results in a loss of energy. This loss of energy is marked by a discoloration ring in the material in which the decay occurs. And this is how a halo forms. Polonium-218, which would be the beginning of the decay chain of a polonium halo, has a half-life of only 3 minutes. And that's where Gentry's claim of that these rocks would have to form instantly, because in that amount of time, we would need the rocks to form within 3 minutes in order for this ring formed by the decay of 218 to be visible. Otherwise, it would have just dissipated in molten rock and disappeared. So that's where Gentry gets his idea of we need to form the rocks instantly. But there's a problem for Gentry, and that's that his samples don't seem to actually include polonium halos. Polonium halos should have only 3 distinct rings, and each one of these rings should clearly show polonium. There's no other element known in the polonium-218 decay chain. Now, one of these rings should clearly show polonium-210, because polonium-218 is visible in these rings, as well as other polonium isotopes. However, the energy emission of polonium-210 is very close to that of radon. So what we see is that there's kind of a blur between where polonium-218 would be and radon. They kind of overlap, and we can't really tell by looking at it what exactly is happening here. So the question is, does this ring here correspond to polonium-210, or does it correspond to radon? Now, radon is a gas, and it can travel through the rock and end up in new places, leaving new halos that seem to begin with radon. How we can tell, then, whether it is radon or polonium that the ring we're looking at is, radon, unlike polonium, leaves very light tracks in the rock of interest. We can tell where polonium has moved. And what we've found is that we've found these radon tracks leading to these halos. And so we can conclude that these halos are actually radon halos and not polonium halos. Of course, there are other problems with Gentry's claims. And this kind of goes back to where he's making some dubious remarks about the content of his samples. For instance, he claims that there is pretty much no uranium in the sample. And yet he took these samples from a place specifically mined for its uranium ore content. He also, as I found out in a Nature article, did not actually do sufficient testing to rule out that there would be uranium, there wouldn't be uranium present in the mineral. So his claim seems pretty bizarre considering where he got his samples from, and that there's sufficient reason to doubt it. And lastly, the rocks he chose were not even primordial. He chose samples from the Precambrian, but, as the geologist J. Richard Wakefield points out, and I quote, "Before learning the locations of two of the sites, I suspected that Gentry had used samples from the Superior Province of Archean Age in northern Ontario, because this province has some of the oldest rocks in northern America. Thus, I was surprised to find that his sites were located in the much younger Grenville Province." This is a major blunder on Gentry's part. Louis Moyd made this very point to Gentry in person when Gentry visited to get his samples. "It is apparent that Gentry knows next to nothing about Precambrian geology because he lumps all the Precambrian rocks into one unit, the created one." So the problem we see here is that Gentry assumes that because it's in Precambrian strata, it must be primordial, when in fact Precambrian signifies a great deal of time, some several million years, some several hundred million years. And so he takes the newer rocks and claims that it is true for the older ones. So that's the problem with his geological claim, is that the rocks really are primordial in the first place. So even if we had these polonium halos, even if we required the instant formation of these rocks, it still wouldn't indicate that the entire Earth was formed quickly because we're not looking at primordial rock. It could have just been a rock recently that formed very quickly, which would still be interesting to geology, but definitely not would lead. It definitely would not lead to the conclusion that the Earth is somehow 6,000 years old. So in sum, Gentry's halos are not actually polonium. They're more likely uranium, which, unlike polonium, has a very long half-life. Also, the rock samples he chose were not in primordial rock. He simply assumed, wrongly, that all Precambrian rocks are primordial when he took his samples. Moving on now from the creationist claim, I'd like to touch on the main topic of this week's podcast, which is thermodynamics. I recently completed a course last quarter that dealt heavily with thermodynamics, and as I know, the discussion of thermodynamics is often needed to counter the claims made by creationists, I felt it would be a good topic to start out with. Now, most of you are probably familiar with the second law claim made by creationists, which is that evolution can't happen because it takes energy and entropy only increases. Basically, what they're saying is that disorder always increases no matter what, so therefore evolution can't get more and more ordered and complex because things should get more disordered. Now, the blatant flaw with this, of course, is that entropy only increases in a closed system. In an open system, parts of the system can decrease in entropy because entropy increases in another part of the system. Overall, the system will increase in entropy, but there are parts where entropy can flow one way or the other, and we can get a decrease in entropy, which is exactly what we see with this claim. The sun is what, in this instance, gives us energy and provides us with the ability to organize and order. So that's the flaw with the second law claim, and I believe in an earlier podcast I had touched on this, but I didn't check. But instead of focusing on just a single creationist claim here, I thought it'd be nice just to give a big overview of thermodynamics and then explain what the laws of thermodynamics are so we get a better understanding of them. So without further ado, let's move on into the topic. Thermodynamics is the study of energy and its movement. We're mainly going to be dealing with thermal energy, which, to make things simple, is going to be representative of all kinetic energies in a system combined. So, what does that mean? Basically, we're looking at the motions of all the atoms in a system, because velocity is related to kinetic energy. So when we look at these different speeds of these atoms, we're looking at all of their energies. And when we sum all of these energies up and take an average, the average of all this gives us our thermal energy and therefore our temperature. Also, to make things simple, I'm going to be using gases in my examples. This is because gases involve freely moving particles, whereas with solids and liquids, there are molecular bonds that cause a little bit of a complication to this that I would like to kind of avoid, leave things very simple for everyone to understand. Thermodynamics is a pretty interesting science, and it has a wide variety of applications in fields like physics, chemistry, biology, engineering, and so on. It's helped us understand how to use heat to produce work, such as in a steam engine. And it's also made us realize that there can be no such thing as a perfect engine, so we realize there are limits to how much work we can get out of a certain amount of heat. Now, a perfect engine is an engine in which all of the heat that is put in, all the heat energy, will go towards work, and I'll touch on that in a bit. But now, let's move on to the four laws of thermodynamics. Oddly enough, there's a zeroth law. This was a fundamental law, but wasn't actually named a law until after the others had already been made, and hence that's why it's the zeroth. It's a rather common sense statement, and I don't really know why they made it into a law, so we're not going to spend much more time on it rather than talking about it. It states, if two thermodynamic systems are in equilibrium with a third, they are also in thermal equilibrium with each other. And you can reason this one out pretty well. It shouldn't take much thinking. Thermodynamic equilibrium simply means the average of all the atomic kinetic energies in a system, aka the temperature, are the same as in another. So if two of them are the same as the third one, well, they both logically must be the same as each other. And we'll touch on how this happens, how the energies kind of average out between these two systems when we discuss the second law. Moving on. The first law is a bit more complex, stating the change in internal energy of a system equals the heat in and the work out. I guess before I go any further, I should define what heat is. I kind of mentioned it briefly and then forgot that I hadn't really defined it. Heat is simply energy in motion. It's a movement of energy from one place to another. That's what heat is. Work, on the other hand, is what you might expect it to be. It's using a force to move a certain distance. So that's what the definition of heat and work is. Now, back to the first law. This is a very fundamental law and has a very interesting meaning. Energy neither disappears or appears out of nowhere. It's all conserved. Translated onto a cosmological scale, we can say that the sum energy change in the universe is zero. That energy cannot be created or destroyed. Now, some might say that the existence of energy, then, demands a creator, because where did energy come from? However, as Alan Guth points out in his book, The Inflationary Universe, not all energy is denoted by a positive quantity. That is, there can be negative energy. And this leads to some kind of interesting conclusions about what could happen in the beginning, in the very beginning of the universe, that would not demand a creator. I'm not saying that there is none, but that we can formulate the laws of physics and we can find that they do things in such a way that we don't need a creator. But the key to remember about the first law is that all energy is conserved, that none of it just appears or disappears. And that's why all the other laws kind of work, is because we don't have to worry about some energy spawning out of nowhere. And then having to deal with that, we could never make any kind of real definitive statements about things if energy would just appear and disappear at whim. Moving on to the second law. The second law is perhaps the most discussed thermodynamical law in public circles, and more than likely it's due to the creationist claim. The statement made here is that the entropy of an isolated system, which is not in equilibrium, will only increase, reaching a maximum value at equilibrium. So, what does that mean? For the sake of this discussion, we will call entropy the measure of, quote-unquote, disorder in a system. Now, it's not the most scientific term, but it'll work, because it is kind of what we mean when we say entropy. Now, let's move to an example. Imagine a gas in which there are, at a single instant in time, all the high-speed atoms on one side and all the low-speed atoms on another. So these things are kind of set up so that all the high-speed atoms are stuck on, say, the left side of the gas, and all the low-speed atoms are on the right side of the gas. Now, this is a very ordered system. We have, on one side, all of the high, and on the other side, all the low. In other words, the entropy is very low, because the disorder in the system is also very low. Now, I want you to imagine a gas. This is more like a normal gas, in which all of the atoms are mingled, and the high-speed atoms have collided with the lower ones in enough so that we've produced an average of speeds that's right between the two speeds. So give the gas enough time, and these particles will collide with one another, exchange energy, and eventually we'll have a balance in the energy, reaching an average right about in between the high and the low speeds. Now, once we've reached this equilibrium, which is the point we would be at if this were to occur, we would be at our maximum amount of energy. Entropy cannot increase any more now, because there's a maximum amount of disorder in the system. Everything's kind of combined, and there's no order in the system. Now, the reason that it tends towards this kind of increase in entropy is due to simple numbers. There are only a few possible ordered states and tons of disordered states. Going back to our example, if you had all those atoms lined up with high speed on one side and low speed on the other, that's the most possible ordered state you could get, and that's just, there's only one possibility. Yet there will be countless other combinations that result in less order. So they're just more likely to get that way. In fact, they're so likely to do that we can say that entropy never really decreases in an isolated system, because the numbers just really stack up against that happening. It's more just basically a mathematical fact that entropy will always increase. Before I move on, I'd just like to point out that if I'm going too quickly, please let me know if you have any questions. If I haven't defined the terms well enough, let me know. After taking the class, I kind of feel like I'm going really quickly and that I might not be covering everything that I learned in a quarter that I'm trying to discuss here in maybe half an hour. So just let me know if I'm going too quickly. I'll try to break it down a bit, go a little slower, define things. I just, after taking the course and realizing that it took me a quarter to understand a lot of the stuff on thermodynamics and then trying to sum it up and a 30-minute podcast is not the easiest thing. And if I'm going too fast, I will slow down. Now moving on to the second law and the discussion of a heat engine, the perfect heat engine. I said before I would talk about why such an engine cannot exist. A perfect engine would be one that, as we put in all of our heat, all of it goes to useful work, none of it's wasted and goes to a cold reservoir, that is, the surroundings. But in reality, systems always tend towards this equilibrium with the environment that they're in contact with. So some of the heat that goes to work will always leave and go out into the external environment, which is at a temperature difference. Without a temperature difference, you cannot really have a flow of heat. Now, note that you can do 100% work with heat for one time only. But in order for it to have this kind of cyclic effect that an engine actually is, you would need to have a compression and expansion. And in order for one of those to occur, it could be the compression, it could be the expansion, you need to lose some heat. So, for instance, there's gas in a jar. We're going to an example of gas again. We have a gas in a jar, and there's a piston on top. And there's a weight sitting on that piston. So, this gas is underneath it being held in by this airtight piston. There's no leaking. And so we put this airtight jar filled with gas over a fireplace. And we let the fire kind of warm up and heat it. And as we heat the gas, it will expand, and it's going to push the piston with the weight upwards. So we're doing work, we're using a force to move this a distance upwards. So once we've reached our maximum point for the heat, we kind of just sit there. Now in order for the piston to lower and then raising up the mass again, we have to have heat leave the system. And so this goes back to the perfect engine thing. We need to have heat leaving the system in order to have a cycle of work. This is why we cannot have a perfect heat engine where all of the heat goes directly to work. Moving on now to the last and third law. This law discusses the impossibility of reaching the absolute zero temperature and the nature of entropy at such a temperature. Now this one's a little tricky, but it's derived from the definition of what entropy is, the mathematical definition. The math is such that, as the temperature lowers, and keep in mind that the math has been based off of observation, as the temperature lowers, entropy will increase. However, the formula is much like, say, 1 over x, where x is our temperature. The lower the temperature, the higher the entropy is going to get. However, it's going to approach infinity as we approach zero for temperature. And since we can't have infinite entropy, absolute zero is forbidden. Now the basic ideas to take away from thermodynamics and this discussion is that isolated systems, that is, ones that aren't in contact with one another, are always going to have an increase in entropy. That the universe as a whole is increasing in entropy and slowly cooling down because, as far as we can tell, the universe as a whole is an isolated system. The whole reason that we can conclude that the universe is running down, that entropy is increasing, is because of the first law. All energy is going to be conserved. If it wasn't conserved, we couldn't make any statement about the sum entropy of the universe because energy would just pop out of nowhere and we could have an ordered state now, or a more ordered state than we had previously. But since this doesn't happen via the first law, we know that entropy is always going to be increasing in the universe. However, while the universe as a whole will increase in entropy, various places in the universe can decrease in entropy due to the flow of entropy. Entropy can be higher in one place, while the energy given off by, say, the sun, will cause a decrease in entropy in another system. The system as a whole, if we look at the entire isolated system, entropy will increase. But if we look at part of a system, entropy can decrease in a certain spot. Bam, that's the basics to thermodynamics. I really feel I haven't done it justice. As I said before, I'd taken it for a whole quarter, and now I just summed it up in a quick little podcast. So there's a lot I had to leave out. But I hope the basics of thermodynamics have gotten across to you, how it works, and maybe if you want to see how it applies to creationist claims. I know there's one about the second law, and perhaps even the first law, but other than that, I haven't really heard anything from creationists that involves the thermodynamical laws. Well, that's all I have planned for this week's podcast. I thought it would be a lot longer than it was. I had a lot of stuff written down on my notes, but apparently I was able to cover it quicker than I thought. I hadn't done this in about 6 months, so I didn't really know how it would go. I seemed to stumble a bit more than I did when I was doing these podcasts regularly, but hopefully I'll be able to pick up on that given a few more episodes. Well, I don't have any ideas planned out for the next few episodes yet, but I have a few things in mind. I recently read the book Creationism's Trojan Horse, which talks about the intelligent design movement and the various political schemes they have in order to try and get intelligent design into the schools, or this whole notion of critical analysis and teaching the controversy in the schools, and kind of manipulating politicians, and kind of taking advantage of everyone's notion of what fairness is, and trying to move that into the academic realm where fairness doesn't really apply in teaching stuff in, say, science classes. It's what's right, it's what goes there. It's not, well, I want to be taught there too, my idea might be totally insane, but please be fair, I call it scientific. So I'll probably be doing a podcast discussing the book Creationism Trojan Horse. But if you have any ideas, now that you know I'm podcasting again, you want to hear me talk about them, I can do some research and try to use those as an idea for the next week's podcast. So please email me. My email is rlippens, L-I-P-P-E-N-S, @wavecable.com. I'll be using this email until it might run out, and then I might switch to my college email, but until then, I'm going to stick with the one I was using before. So that's all I have to talk about this week. Hopefully, I'll have enough planned out next week so that I can do one next week. I might be a little busy in college. I have quite a few classes that it was recommended I didn't take because it would make my schedule really difficult, but I decided to do it anyway because I'm insane like that. So hopefully, it's not going to pin me down too much, and I don't expect it to. Until next week, then, send me your ideas. Let me know what you think. Hope you're all glad to see that the podcast is kind of starting back up again. So until then, have a great week, and we will talk next time.